This is a journey into sound. This is a journey into sound. A journey which along the way will bring to you new color, new dimension, new value.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
I've got a question about the word suicide. But not as it refers to its literal meaning. When I was a little kid, my brother and I would go to a convenience store or a fast food place where you could fill up your own soda. And when you put different types of soda into your glass, that was called a suicide. And I thought that was just something my brother and I said, but I guess it's not. Everybody I know says that. And I was just wondering how that word got attached to doing that.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into...
Think Benjamin Franklin looked just like God, because his picture's the hottest commodity on the planet. And for all man's technological advances, enough pictures of that God could drive most of this world's peaceful people to homicide. In fact, I'd have to say that we're even less civilized, because today for enough cash, you can get your preacher in with you on that drive-by. And he'll be sitting right next to you in the hoorah, wearing that same purple robe with the gold stripe, talking about, come on, man, I got a Bible class at 5, what we sitting here for? Don't bitch up now, sit, ride or die. And a young man on my block told me in the same documents that there's evidence that some of these U.S. presidents been involved in drug trafficking. And I was like, well, good investigative work, Sherlock, but for the cops on this here block, the only thing that matters is they get paid for incarcerating Africans. And when that judge is looking at you holier than thou, best believe inside he got a happy grin. And he might let you go on that long shot Rico, because when he catch you for life in them 3 strikes when you ask him back again. And the irony is that same judge probably owns stock in them same trucks to bring your suppliers drugs to New York. But if you want to put your way for life, don't blame him, it's not his fault. If you want an immunity from crime, your dumb ass should have joined the force. Or better yet, you should have went to law school, passed the bar, set up shop, practice criminal law, where you could lie for and rob your clients so they put you on the bench, you earn your living, giving more disillusioned young men that life sentence. It's more profitable to earn 1% off the efforts of 100 people than 100% off your own. And them leaders to whom you listening got you picketing and petitioning. From your term, from your mission, your landlord will be fixing the stick eviction notices on your home. Mm-hmm. And you can sit on your couch with your children on the curb outside what used to be your building while you explain to them how you can't even get a return phone call from that same leader that you helped to raise that $500,000. And when you look into your children's crying eyes, they will know that what you think you know, you don't.
Why would thousands of artifacts be ignored by mainstream archaeology? They show the unthinkable. Images of man battling with dinosaurs. Reptilian creatures interacting with men and women. Ancient inscriptions on stones depicting complex surgical procedures. And carved metallic spheres found in rock strata 2.8 billion years old. This evidence points to one conclusion, that the history of life on this planet may be radically different than what is accepted today.
Many years ago on the Mississippi River boats, they had men called gaugers. And the job of a gauger was to hang off the side of the boat with one hand, and in the other hand he had a ball of twine with a hunk of lead on the end of it. Wheel the lead around his head and let it fly into the water. And wherever the water marked the twine, he'd call up to the skipper and say, "Marking on the twine is 4 fathoms." Of course, course, day in and day out, year after year, this would get pretty monotonous. Until in the 1800s, a little man came along and revolutionized the whole gauging industry. Instead of saying marking on the twine, he cut it short and said, Mark Twain. And in between each marking, he'd fill it in with a little patter about himself and his everyday life. Well, if you'd been living at that time, coming up from a distance on the Mississippi, would have sounded like this. Mark Twain. Four fathoms off the starboard bow, I got a gal named Cindy Lou. Feeds me gin and baked beans too. Mark Twain. Mark Twain. 3 fathoms off the starboard bow, I got a friend, his name is Pete. Sings dirty songs down on Beale Street. Mark Twain. Mark Twain. 2 fathoms off the starboard bow, I've been working the river since 92. I get a penny a day and bad liquor too. Mark Twain. I'm gonna save my money till I die. They gonna bury me all but my good right eye. Mark Twain. Mark Twain. Fathoms of the starboard bow, look out skipper, pull it to the side, you gon' bust your bow and split your hide. Ooh, great God, we done run aground, skipper gon' chase me with a big bloodhound. Mark Twain.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? We have come now with our microphones to the grand ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. Here we find a very distinguished audience in the midst of a celebration. The occasion is the 100th anniversary of the birth of Mark Twain. Mark Twain, the writer of so many words of wisdom and creator of so many beloved fictional characters. Dr. William Lyon Phelps is acting as Toastmaster tonight, and during this broadcast we'll introduce many, many celebrities from many, many places. We turn you over now to Dr. Phelps.
The one who just introduced me was Mr. Norman Brokenshire. Now we're on the air from Hawaii to Great Britain to Mexico, South America, Philippines, West Indies, and Bermuda, as well as every city and town in the United States. As you all know, we hope very much that Clara Gabrielowitsch, the daughter of Mark Twain, could be here. We have her daughter here, as you know, and we've seen her and heard her. But Clara has written at my request a few lines that I'm going to read to you, a message to you all. My dear friends, I wish I might be with you tonight on this great occasion. I should like to thank you in person for the wonderful things I know you'll say about my father. But I wonder if many of you appreciate the greatest of his qualities, the breadth and depth of his courage. Courage, yes, that godlike gift which consumes the pitiful caution and selfish fears of the weak. father was courageous in big events and small. He was never cautious, had little of the self-protective instinct, either physical or moral. For example, his opinions of people or things were crystal clear and spouted from his lips like cascades on a rainy day. No one's frowns or other spasms of disapproval could stop the flow from his expressive tongue. My father never tiptoed in life. He strode into events with hobnailed boots on, and he kept them on right through the fray. In spite of a somewhat flashy temper, he was able to control himself in other ways. In fact, I should say that his temptations were mainly towards strength. Physical fights were not frequent in Mark Twain's life, and he even liked to call himself morally lazy and a shirker. Quite the opposite was true, however. He met tribulations and tragedies with sturdy spirit. He labored also to eradicate his faults, fully appreciating the measureless vitality of the will and majestic strength of a determined resolution. Even though he did not engage in physical combat, he frequently went into moral ones. I sometimes wonder if his claim to memory through all these years might not be more as a spiritual patriot than a humorist. Patriotism is surely the dispensation of loving, courageous protection to our people against an intruding enemy. Since we are not obliged to leave the country to find enemies, but discover them well-nourished and active in every corner of our land, it behooves us to bring a powerful offensive against ourselves. This I consider the highest type of patriotism. I hope you will agree with me when I state that my father, Mark Twain, was in the spiritual sense a true patriot. Thank you, dear Clara. Now I'm glad to say that we have some very interesting messages from abroad. Romain Rolland, the great Frenchman, author of Above the Battle, Jean Christophe, and many other works. Very funny, the last time I was in Paris, I met a French count that I knew on the street, and I said, "Can you give me the address of Romain Rolland?" And he bristled up, he said, "No, sir, I am a Frenchman." I said, "Oh, dear, 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 dear." Well, this is his message. Romain Rolland from Villeneuve en France. All homage to him who always lashed falsehood and hypocrisy and injustice. From Sir James M. Barrie. "Am with you tonight to the glorious memory of Mark Twain." From Dr. Ferdinand Verwerka, envoy extraordinary and minister plenipotentiary of Czechoslovakia. "To the memory of Mark Twain, one of the most deeply appreciated American authors in Czechoslovakia, where his characters and humor have delighted young and old and inspired many of our writers. It is with great pleasure that I convey to you the sincere greetings of the people of Czechoslovakia and that we join in paying tribute on this memorable and most worthy occasion." Rudyard Kipling, "I regard Mark Twain as the foremost recorder and revealer of the American spirit of his time." And a little while before that, Mr. Kipling wrote, "To my mind, he was beyond question the largest man of his time, both in the direct outcome of his work and, more important still, if possible, in his indirect influence as a protecting force in an age of iron philistinism. He never seems to me to have said one-tenth of what was in his mind in this direction, even in the implications of Pudd'nhead Wilson, but it was there for later generations to take and use. They don't know their debt, of course, and would be quite surprised if they were told." Rudyard Kipling. And this is the last one from Pirandello. "I am happy to bring tonight my modest contribution to the 100th anniversary of the birth of Mark Twain, to whom I am related like a son to his father or a pupil to his master. And I will never forget that Mark Twain taught me the sense of humor, which is the healthy basis of life."
Here's a joke I don't have a place for. You'll understand why when you hear it.
I was down at CVS, and I had a rather odd assortment of items I needed to get. I had to get a liter of Jack Daniels, a 2-liter bottle of Coca-Cola, a box of condoms, and a 10-pack of blank CDR discs. And I thought it'd be awesome if every morning I went and bought those same four things for like 6 months. Just to develop this really weird reputation with the staff there, where they'd be like, hold on a second, man. This guy drinks a liter of Jack and Coke every day, has sex 12 times a day, and then burns 10 blank CDs? 10 blank CDs? 10 discs? That's like 7.5 gigs a day. What kind of data is he backing up? Wouldn't it make more sense just to get an external hard drive at this point? Is he burning music? Wouldn't it make more sense just to get an iPod? Maybe he's making mix CDs for all these girls that he's making. Two of those girls ain't getting CDs, though. Which two are those? Which two don't get the CDs? I gotta travel a lot when I'm doing stand-up, and I was on a flight one time, and I had a little bit of a runny nose. And so I went like this. All of a sudden, the guy next to me goes, hey, man, you gonna blow your nose, or am I gonna have to listen to you have the sniffles for 6 hours? And I was stunned for two reasons. One, I couldn't believe he'd be so rude to a total stranger. And two, I'd never heard the word sniffles and f***ing in the same sentence together before. Clap if you use Craigslist.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world below. There is no sickness, toil, nor danger in that fair land to which I go. I'm going home to see my mother. I'm going home no more to roam. Just going over Jordan. I am just going over home. Dark clouds will hover o'er me. I know my pathway is rough and steep, but golden fields lie out before me, where weary eyes no more will weep. I'm going. Home with God. I'm going
question. Have you read any good books lately? Maybe a cliche and a gag, I suppose, to some people. But in certain quarters today, there's real concern about the answer that too many of our fellow Americans would have to come up with. In Chicago this past week, at the meetings of the American Library Association, the problem was certainly on the librarians' minds. And here at the University of Chicago, some of our colleagues have given a good deal of thought to America's reading habits, and they're prepared to argue that those habits are pretty alarming. To discuss this neglect of reading this morning, I'm joined by Professor Leon Karnofsky of the Graduate Library School, who's also editor of the journal The Library Quarterly, by Dean Lester Ashheim of the Graduate Library School, and by Professor Robert E. Streeter, literary scholar and dean of the college, all of them of the University of Chicago. Well, Mr. Karnofsky, you've spoken and written pretty vigorously about this so-called neglect of reading. Do you really think it's a genuine problem here in America?
Well, Mr. Rosenheim, perhaps we might change the word neglect to decline. I suppose it amounts to about the same thing. And I'm inclined to think that there has definitely been a decline of reading in this country. I would make three points. First of all, I think in the 19th century, people generally did a lot more reading than they do today. Secondly, in more recent years, I have the definite feeling that people who formerly read books and magazines either don't read them at all or they read appreciably less than they used to. And in the third place, I feel that reading in this country is certainly a whole lot less important or occupies a much less important place in relation to the population than it does in other countries.
Well, that's a pretty depressing sort of indictment, it seems to me, Mr. Karnofsky. Dean Ashheim, would you go along with it?
Well, I would certainly say this, that it is not only the scholars in the university who are concerned with this problem. We have seen how popular acceptance has taken up Mr. Flesch's book on why Johnny can't read, and this certainly reflects a very real concern on the part of parents that indeed their children do not read as well as they used to do. We know perfectly well that it is a matter of concern also that our homes just do not have space for books anymore, and while there is always a place for your TV set, bookshelves are almost never part of the original design.
So that the decline in square footage of bookshelf space is in itself a fairly significant symptom. Well, how about it from the standpoint of the teacher of literature, Dean Streeter? Do you, again, go along with this general picture?
Well, I have a purely personal impression to offer that is, in my line of work, it's sometimes desirable or at least tempting to make passing references to figures in literature, people like Mr. Micawber or Hamlet or Moby Dick or Little Lord Fauntleroy. And I think I've just about concluded that there is no single book or play, what have you, that you can assume that most 18-year-old college freshmen have read or are familiar with in any real way.
You just
don't count on it anymore.
And that wouldn't have been true, you suppose, 40 or 50 years ago.
Well, that's the impression I have.
I suppose the Bible would be one safe bet in, say, a half century ago, wouldn't it?
I think so. And the Garden of Eden is even a difficult one to be sure of at the present time.
with a little, with a lot. You still expect a loving first after showing all you've got. I've seen it in your eyes, I've read it in books. Who wants love without the looks? Hugs. People get ready, there's a train of coming. You don't need no ticket, you just get on board. Once I like crying, twice I like laughter. Come on, tell me what I'm after.
Well, how about sort of supporting these general assertions? I mean, we've been talking about impressions and a few isolated facts and phenomena. Is there real evidence by people who've examined the thing analytically that people aren't reading in this country? What about it, Mr. Karnofsky?
Well, there are several lines of evidence that might be cited, but one which is quite impressive is the status of the bookstore. It's been estimated that we have perhaps 1,500 to 2,000 bookstores in all of the United States. But even this figure is perhaps a little too large, because nearly half of them are concentrated in only four states, New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, and California. And in many of our very large cities, cities of 50,000 or more, they either have a very small and fairly specialized bookstore, or a bookstore which handles really books as a sideline to greeting cards, stationery, and the like, or else they don't have any at all. In contrast with this, I think anyone who's gone to Europe can't help but be impressed with the fact that just about any city, or every city of any size at all, will have not one, but a good many rather good bookstores.
Well, of course, this is statistical evidence that sounds fairly alarming. On the other hand, isn't it true that in the United States there's more literacy than there is any place else? Aren't we very proud of this fact?
I think Mr. Karnofsky's been talking about quantity, and it's I think perfectly clear that quantitatively there's never been a more completely verbal civilization, perhaps, than the one in the United States today. I mean, we're thinking, for instance, of the businessman who, although he may not be a great book reader in his off hours, actually his entire working life is bound up with the writing, the reading of memoranda. It's totally verbal.
There is another problem here, though. If we talk about book reading, there is a definite low percentage of the total population who reads books. Any polls that have been made over the past 10 years come up with almost an identical figure, that not more than about 25% of the population has read as much as a single book in the past month. And if we ask them, are you reading a book now, the percentage goes even lower than that.
That's that was certainly shown just recently in 55 when one of the Gallup polls, when he asked the question, are you currently reading a book, only 17% of the adults in this country said they were. In contrast with this, the figure was 55% in Great Britain. As a matter of fact, among the major democracies, the United States ranked pretty low. England was highest, then Norway, Canada, Australia, and Sweden, and finally came the United States. We definitely are not a book-reading nation, at least in comparison with these other countries that I've just mentioned.
Well, why is this so? I mean, I want to return to this point that we may not be reading books, but we're reading everything else. I spoke a moment ago about the businessman, but anyone who drives a car is completely at the mercy, really, of his ability to respond immediately to sometimes fairly complicated sets of symbols.
He's what somebody suggested could be called a Rhodes Scholar. Well, we're literate in that sense, I take it, but you've already provided certain evidence that we're not reading books, or at least books of the kind that you consider are worth reading. What are the reasons for this, in this flourishing, active, and highly intelligent citizenry of ours? How does it happen that we're not reading books?
Now everybody tell, ooh, schools are out of control. Oh, they're out of control. We need prayer in the schools. We don't need prayer in schools. We need to toss Salad Man in school. That'll straighten the kids out. Hey, Jimmy, you got a D. You know what you got to do? No! No! I don't want to toss a salad. I don't want to toss a salad. I'm a read. I'm a learn to read.
This language that I'm about to spit is basically forbidden. And I can't promise you that I'm gonna live long enough to finish this, but me and you are the same. The only difference is, one of us knows exactly what his sentence is. And I might drive like I ain't got no sense, but I get around. And in my short time on this planet, I done traveled a great many distances. And now I'm here, hearing the trigger pulled, standing, staring in the barrel of a shotgun, and I got enough heart to pump all the blood and oil out of this planet, but this motherfucker standing in front of me ain't even got none. So I try to relax and think back to times by the pool when I was cooking barbecue for my moms and my fams and herbals and hen rock with my mans. It's low intensity warfare like seances with goat's blood and horsehair, but this government be trying to run Jedi mind tricks, and this is the hood, and I'll be the master of the force here, but my bullet is coming. And I'm willing to die to prove that I'm the realest alive. These motherfuckers might be out of their minds, but my thoughts are so sick that they make things throw up like gang signs. And this society don't give a fuck about me unless I'm swinging from a basketball rim or a tree. But my watch got bling that's fit for a king, so I ain't gotta concern myself with nobody's hang time. And I keep a fresh pack of zigzags, so why would they think that I would stay in line? Picture me getting popped for jaywalking and actually paying a fine. For me being real ain't just an act, it's a state of mind. My every fashion, my every action is strictly thug passion like hypnotic. And my girlfriend ain't got no sense, so my bullets come out psychotic. And I can bust them into your lungs until your gums bump melodic. But I'm trying to stay never ignorant and getting goals accomplished. Dear mama, you're protected by the 7-day theory. Holla if you hear me, I promise. And my words will be around to the end of time, cause the sentiment behind them is timeless. And these motherfuckers think they know me, but can't see me in Milan with my woman spitting Shakespearean sonnets. The only thing they know is what the media tell them. The only thing they think I promote is violence, and I can see the bullets spinning. And still, it be all eyes on me. Real niggas needed something to believe in, and I'm as real as a god could be. And as this bullet rotate towards my face, now it's all that my eyes could see. And my final thought is that even in my death, real niggas will still have to live their lives through me.
Won't you take this dance, this dance?
Is fast approaching. That means millions of people are going to be burning through their savings, lining up just to get their hands on the latest technology, completely oblivious to the fact that they are actually paying to have their private conversations recorded and shared with third parties. Take the new Samsung Smart TV. The amount of data that this thing collects is staggering.
Just say what you want.
Find us action adventure.
It logs where, when, how and for how long you use the TV. It sets tracking cookies and beacons designed to detect when you have viewed particular content or a particular email message. It records the apps you use, the websites you visit, and how you interact with content. And it, of course, has a built-in camera and microphone with facial and voice recognition for your convenience. But Samsung's new global privacy policy for its line of smart TVs comes with a rather ominous warning. Please be aware that if your spoken words include personal or other sensitive information, that information will be among the data that's captured and transmitted to a third party. In other words, don't say anything private in front of your television.
They've been watching us.
Now, writing about the privacy policy for Salon.com, Michael Price writes, "I do not doubt that this data is important to providing customized content and convenience, but it's also incredibly personal, constitutionally protected information that should not be for sale to advertisers and should require a warrant for law enforcement to access. There's no need for the FBI to bug your living room. You'll do it yourself." In 2 years' time, the stuff that this Samsung TV can do will be old news.
What's wrong?
Let's say you're having a fight with your spouse in front of your television. Well, that camera and microphone that's been surreptitiously recording all of your private conversations and scanning your body language can now send that information to third-party advertisers so that they can air a perfectly timed commercial suggesting some SSRIs. For them, it's all about targeted advertising. But for the surveillance apparatus, it's about complete information control.
Its primary intention is to transmit data. It receives data from smart appliances, which will be in your home, so that they can, you know, then immediately push back to you what they feel that you need in that moment for advertising purposes. It's not giving us more control. It's actually giving the control to big corporations, to utilities, and to governments who will be sharing in this data that is basically being extracted from the home in a very, very high level of detail.
All of this spying is documented. It's been going on for decades, and now people are just buying into the idea that they need all of these new smart appliances to save the earth and save on energy bills, when in reality, these devices are ushering in a new era of total surveillance bondage. Lining up to buy their crap is helping to construct the Panopticon.
What's wrong?
I need something stronger.
Take 4 red capsules. In 10 minutes, take 2 more. Help is on the way.
Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, melt, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag it, drop it, zip, unzip it, lock it, fill it, curl it, find it, view it, code it, jump and lock it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, force it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, ring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, start format.
This is the first picture ever to be sent back from a comet. It was beamed 300 million miles back to Earth from a lander put there by scientists to find out more about our planet's history. The image seems to show the Philae lander, which is roughly the size of a washing machine, in a shadow surrounded by sheer rocky cliff. Philae was launched from its mothership Rosetta on Wednesday, the climax of a 10-year odyssey for the European Space Agency. But there have been some technical difficulties since it left Rosetta. During Philae's 7-hour descent to the comet, harpoons designed to anchor it failed to deploy, raising concerns the lander might drift back into space. The European Space Agency is now planning a correction manoeuvre in the early hours of Friday to try and secure Philae to the comet, and it's hoped the lander will start drilling into the comet on Friday, and that the samples drilled out from it will unlock details about how the planets and possibly even life evolved, as the rock and ice that make up comets preserve ancient organic molecules like a time capsule. Comets date back to the formation of the solar system some 4.6 billion years ago, and scientists suspect impacting comets delivered water to early Earth.
Buy it, use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, melt, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, snap it, work it, quick erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, crack it, drop it, zip, unzip it, lock it, fill it, curl it, find it, view it, code it, jump and lock it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, thrust it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it.
itself. Pretty clever, eh? Well, a two-day driverless car contest kicked off this morning in Changshu in East China's Jiangsu province. Up to 22 self-driving cars from 14 universities and research institutions are competing with each other. The competition's called Future Challenge 2014. There are two categories, the expressways and suburban roads, and the urban roads. Well, in the first day race, these cars will cover 15 kilometers around a local lake. They have to make a 90-degree turn, one of the biggest challenges in the race. The performance is graded according to what you might want to call the four S's: safety, smartness, smoothness, and speed. This year's contest is the sixth of its kind.
Surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, bring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stop, format it, buy it, use it, break it, fix it, crash it, change it, mail, upgrade it, charge it, on it, tune it, press it, tap it, work it, erase it, write it, get it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, crack it, drop it, zip it, unzip it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, tune it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it, touch it, bring it, pay it, watch it, turn it, leave it, stop, format it, buy it, use it, break it, fix it, crash it, change it, mail, upgrade it, charge it, point it, zoom it, press it, tap it, work it, quick, erase it, write it, get it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick, rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, crack it, drop it, zip, unzip it, surf it, scroll it, pose it, click it, cross it, crack it, switch, update it, name it, read it, cue it, print it, scan it, send it, fax, rename it. Technologic. Technologic. Technologic.
Believe it or not, scientists backed by the Pentagon's research agency DARPA have tested a smart chip that can mimic human brain functions while flying in a drone. These smart chips, which are neuromorphic, have been researched in academic and corporate labs for about 7 years now. They operate by tapping into a network of neurons that communicate in spikes of electricity. And not only are they more energy efficient than a conventional chip, they also have the ability to reprogram themselves to learn new skills. But now scientists with HRL Laboratories, Center for Neural and Emergent Systems, have taken that chip and found a way for it to learn on the fly, quite literally speaking. It's all laid out in a recent MIT review that outlines an experiment that tested the drone using three different rooms. The first time the drone was flown into each room, it used incoming sensor data from the walls, the furniture, and other objects in the room to create a pattern of electrical activity. According to the report, that triggered the device to figure out that it was in a new space and also caused the ways its neurons connected to one another to change in a crude mimic of learning in a real brain. Those changes meant that next time the craft entered the same room, it recognized it and signaled as such. But perhaps what's so unique about this device is its size. This particular drone is 6 inches square, 1.5 inches high, weighs only 93 grams, and uses only 50 milliwatts of power. And that's astonishing considering how much power it would take for a conventional computer to run software that could learn the DNA of a similar room. Not surprisingly, the laboratory's owners, GM and Boeing, are already considering how they can commercialize the technology. It's one that could really revolutionize how artificial intelligence is incorporated into many different industries, and that includes surveillance. There are a lot of questions about what this might mean for privacy, especially considering this is a small, fairly inconspicuous aircraft with a tiny electric brain.
Ever since the internet was created, it's been organized around basic principles of openness, fairness, and freedom. There are no gatekeepers deciding which sites you get to access. There are no toll roads on the information superhighway. This set of principles, the idea of net neutrality, has unleashed the power of the internet and given innovators the chance to thrive. Abandoning these principles would threaten to end the internet as we know it. That's why I'm laying out a plan to keep the internet free and open. And that's why I'm urging the Federal Communications Commission to do everything they can to protect net neutrality for everyone. They should make it clear that whether you use a computer, phone, or tablet, internet providers have a legal obligation not to block or limit your access to a website. Cable companies can't decide which online stores you can shop at or which streaming services you can use. And they can't let any company pay for priority over its competitors. To put these protections in place, I'm asking the FCC to reclassify internet service under Title II of a law known as the Telecommunications Act. In plain English, I'm asking them to recognize that for most Americans, the internet has become an essential part of everyday communication and everyday life. The FCC is an independent agency, and ultimately this decision is theirs alone. But the public has already commented nearly 4 million times asking the FCC to make sure that consumers, not the cable company, gets to decide which sites they use. Americans are making their voices heard and standing up for the principles that make the internet a powerful force for change. As long as I'm president, that's what I'll be fighting for too.
The internet is not a big truck. The internet is not something that you just dump something on. The internet is not a big truck. The internet is a series of tools. The internet is not a big truck. The internet is not something that you just dump something on. The internet is not a big truck. The internet. Streaming stuff under the internet. Why? Tubes. The internet is tubes. Connections. Consumers. Massive commercial purposes. Big truck. Long distance. It's tubes. Tangled up tubes. Enormous series of tubes. Your own personal internet. The World Wide Web. The internet is tubes. Tubes. Those tubes can be filled. And if they're filled, the internet is going to be delayed. A series of tubes. The internet is not a big truck. The internet is not something that you just dump something on. I want to make sure people understand my position. These people are asking for regulation, okay? I just the other day got internet was sent by my staff at 10 o'clock in the morning on Friday. I got it yesterday. See, we want to talk about the consumer. Let's talk about you,
Mr.
and
Chairman,
me.
Al,
yes, sir.
I'm sorry. I thought you were finished. I'm sorry.
No, I'm not finished. These people are massively invading this world of the internet. Why? Tubes. The internet is tubes.
Providers. Consumers.
Movies delivered to your house.
Big truck.
Small business.
Is tubes.
Tangled up tubes.
Enormous
series of tubes.
Your own personal internet.
The World Wide Web. The internet is tubes.
Tubes.
Those tubes can be filled. And if they're filled, the
tubes.
Internet is going to be delayed. A series of tubes.
The internet is providers.
The internet is
consumers.
The tubes. Internet is you and me. The internet is not a big truck.
The people who are streaming through a whole book at a time.
Tubes.
Maybe there is a place for the internet.
And again, the internet is a series of tubes.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
Looking for the perfect world.
Perfect world.
Looking for the perfect world.
Looking for the perfect world. a chess game. TV ratings moving up, it's the best game. Moving the opponent in a chess game. TV ratings moving up, it's the best. Moving up, it's moving up, moving up, it's the best. It's moving up, it's moving up. Men with suits and ties, sitting on shots. Men with suits and ties, sit. Men with suits and ties, sitting on shots. Shots, call shots from a chair. With hummus coming at night, with dark light.
More drama looking through the sunroof at a show party.
With hummus coming at night, with dark light.
More drama looking through the sunroof at a show party.
With heavy equipment, journalists ask me questions with armor. With questions with armor. No compass for direction, no choice to sleep. With no selection, music bumping, 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 jumping. Looking for the perfect world, looking for the perfect world.
Moving the opponent in a chess game, TV ratings moving up, it's the best game. Moving the opponent in a chess game, TV ratings moving up, it's moving up, moving up, moving up, moving up, moving up, moving up.
Go find the others.com.
Is that not the greatest suicide ever?
Yeah.
That's the point I was making.